Good morning, everyone. Today we're in the middle of a series, Why I Go to Church. This is a series where you get to travel through history of your speaking team to see why it is that we spend our Sunday mornings with you. It's been a good series for us to explore as well. We look at the question, why do I go to church? Why don't I just sleep in? And when I wake up, if I'm of the mind, I can simply read a book about God while sipping tea and wiggling my toes in my bunny slippers. Why indeed? Well, I should start out by telling you that I identify as a Congra Katha Prespa Naza Gatio Cadia Vignitarian. I'll say it again. A Congra Katha Prespa Naza Gatio Cadia Vignitarian. Now, for those of you who are frantically Googling the term, assuming you can spell it, which I bet you can't, you won't find it. Why? Because I'm the only one. I'm unique, as is my church heritage. I'm a bit of Congregational, some Catholic, some Presbyterian, Nazarene, a bit more Congregational, some Arcadia Fellowship, Independence, lots of Vineyard, and ending with Arian because it sounded good, and because, why not? It's my journey. My first memories of church involved sitting in the third row of Altadena Community Congregational Church with my parents. I wore black patent leather shoes that my mother shined with Vaseline, white socks with lace ruffles, and some sort of hideously uncomfortable starchy dress with a tulle petticoat that made it stand out perpendicular to the rest of me. We must not forget the gloves and the hat, because that's how it was in the 1950s. Starchy. I would sit on the third row with my parents gladly, because I flatly refused to go to Sunday school. You see, the pastor's wife was the teacher, and on a good day, she seemed like she'd been baptized in lemon juice. A sour woman was she, and on a bad day, when her class got the wiggles, she spewed hellfire and brimstone. So at the age of 5, I went on strike, and since my parents' value was to avoid a scene at all costs, I was allowed to join them on the third row every Sunday. At the age of 5, sermons can get a bit long, and our pastor seemed to like to continue to talk about 15 minutes after his content was exhausted. Even my parents said so. He also spoke in a monotone, and he punctuated every syllable with preacher's consonants. And that was an old-timey way that preachers talked, stressing the last syllable. We thank you, our most holy God, and so on. Well, I devised a way to entertain myself without doing anything that would get me in very much trouble. We had a full choir that sat in the choir loft in full view of the third row. And I found out that if you make eye contact with someone and you yawn, they'll yawn as well. Try it sometime. I do it to you now, but I don't think it translates over the internet. Sometimes, though, I actually listen to the sermon. And at the ripe old age of 5, it occurred to me that the pastor did not believe what he was saying. When he talked about the love of God, he looked like he'd just eaten an uncured olive. When he talked about Jesus' crucifixion, he might as well have been reading a grocery list. And his prayers were filled with so many flowery words, preacher's consonants, and King James English, that I don't think he even knew what he was talking about. I believed in God. Even at the age of 5, I would look around me at my mother's garden and my father's pine trees, the birds, the butterflies, the clouds, and all manner of lovely things. I had no doubt they were designed by someone, and someone who is far above what I could imagine. So that left me with a disparity. Believing in God, but not believing in the pastor. So during my years at Altadena Congregational Church, I entertained myself by training the choir to yawn on demand, and I set my theological musings on the back burner. When I was in third grade, the church went through a crisis, and apparently I was not alone at judging our pastor to be less than inspiring, because he was fired in a very ugly way. And my parents took the opportunity to sleep in on Sundays and quit making my brother dress up in a suit, and I gratefully put aside my Vaseline-smeared shoes and starchy, scratchy dresses. The disparity nagged at me, or at least it did so on the back burner. And when I was in junior high, I fell head over heels in puppy love with a boy named John Spriesterbach, who was Catholic. Suddenly, I was filled with a passion for going to church and rekindling my relationship with God. Or at least that's how I sold it to my mother, who I think was just thankful that I wasn't going to be a heathen when I grew up. So she bought me a lace headscarf and a copy of the Catholic Missal and dropped me off at the 8 o'clock service, which coincidentally, John and his parents happened to attend. Now, I should say that my parents were a bit old-fashioned and they felt strongly that a young lady should be taught a classical education, which means, in addition to going to public school, I also took extracurricular classes in Latin, which was fantastic because in the 1960s, the Catholic masses were also in Latin, and I could understand it and participate it, probably more so than many of the lifelong Catholics who sat beside me in the pews. It seemed fine to me that I had a language that I could talk to God in that was different from the one that I yelled at my brother with. And the Gregorian chants that the nuns sang were just otherworldly, and they transported me right into the arms of God. As a matter of fact, once I got done swooning over John Spriesterbach, I became transfixed by the awe and the pageantry of the Catholic Church, the rituals, the incense, the chanting, the reciting of the prayers, and communion. How I longed to take communion. So I enrolled in catechism class, determined to become the uber class Catholic, so I could receive the wafer and the wine from the priest. But here's where my Protestant roots betrayed me. When we were discussing the need for confession before a priest, I asked about the book of Hebrews, specifically chapter 4, verses 4 through 16. It says this, "Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we possess, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne with grace, his throne of grace, sorry, with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." I asked the priest, "Why can't we confess our sins directly to Jesus?" That brought me an invitation to stay after class and to speak with the priest privately. A dear man of God, his name was Father Phelan, and after speaking with me gently for almost an hour, listening to my questions and answering them as best he could, he sat quietly for a moment, and then he said words I will never forget. "You know, you would make a much better Protestant than a Catholic." I went home devastated, mostly because I misunderstood and I thought I'd been excommunicated. And I'd gone far enough in catechism class to know what that meant. Dante's hellfire and brimstone, Jonathan Edwards, sinners in the hands of an angry God. That was apparently my eternal destiny. So I took some time off of church and some time away from God, as if one could actually do that. And I lived the carefree life of a high schooler in the late 1960s. Because if one's going to burn in hell for all eternity, then one might as well taste as many forbidden fruits as one can, right? Brilliant. Well, I may have taken time away from God, but God certainly didn't take time away from me. In fact, there was pretty much a steady whisper going on inside my soul throughout my high school years. And finally, I listened. The question that was posed to me was this: "So how is your life going for you now that you're doing things your own way?" Well, it stunk, actually. The verse came to mind, "There is a way that seems right to a man," or in my case, a woman, "but that way is the way of death." My best friend at the time was a fellow classical musician, and we both accompanied the John Muir Choir. Well, mostly she did the work and I turned the pages because she read music and I don't. But she was a Christian, a real one, one who believed what she said she believed, and even more, lived that way. So on that day, I told her my life was a wreck and I needed to do something about it. She led me through the sinner's prayer, and I determined to change the direction that my life was going. I started attending church with her, Glendora Nazarene Church, as a matter of fact. And for those of you not familiar with Nazarenes, they are part of the holiness stream, which teaches many things. But there's a great emphasis on a relationship with Jesus. Now, the theology may have gone over my head, but the relational aspect of Jesus appealed to me. I'd learned thus far that there could be a disparity between what one says about God and how one actually believes. I had learned the awestruck wonder of encountering God in worship. But I had never to this point realized that one could have an actual relationship with Jesus. So I spent a good amount of time at the altar, which was big in the Nazarene church, so that I could confess my sins and be pure enough to deserve a relationship with God. And that took me through college, Point Loma College, an institution of the Church of the Nazarene. That was where we went. And you should have heard the spellouts of their name at basketball games. You know, give me a P, give me an O, give me an I, and so on all the way through the end of Nazarene. They lasted almost until halftime. But anyway, that's where I met Ben, and we got married our senior year. I loved the Nazarene church, but again, there was a bit of a nagging going on in the back of my soul. I was learning a lot about what not to do, but not very much about what to do, so that I don't do what I'm not supposed to do. What does God actually want me to be like? What does He want me to live like? Well, once Ben and I were married, we moved back to the Altadena, Pasadena area, and decided that we would at least visit one non-Nazarene church, just once, just to see what it's like, before we forever became members of Pasadena First Church in the Nazarene, or PASNAZ, as it was called. So we tried Lake Avenue Congregational Church, a non-denominational megachurch in Pasadena, and Ray Ortland was the pastor at the time, and he happened to preach the week we visited. I'll never forget his sermon. It was on the three priorities that Lake Avenue had adopted. Basically, we'd plopped there right at the beginning of their mission, vision, and value series. The three priorities were these. The first one, your relationship with God. Priority two, your relationship with the church or the body of Christ. And priority three, your relationship with the world. For the first time, I was exposed to what a relationship with God could actually look like, and I began to see that there was a way to live once one finished confession and got up from the altar. That God wanted us to model our lives after Jesus. That was absolutely revolutionary to me, and I began my journey of apprenticing my life with Jesus, and it's a journey I'm still on. And I intend to remain until I am in His presence. So our one-time visit stretched a bit, and we stayed at Lake Avenue Church for 14 years. Now, the picture I've put up about Lake Avenue Church, I'll just give you a little bit of trivia. That sanctuary happened to be remodeled during the time that we were there, and Ben was the project manager. Now, some of you know that Ben is also the project manager on the restoration of Sweet J. It's not going to look like this. He had a different construction crew and budget. Anyway, during that 14-year period, there was a bit of a disconnect between how I wanted to live and how I actually was living. See, our marriage was a bit of a mess. There were a lot of problems. But one certainly was that I had a lot of baggage from growing up that I'd never dealt with. And I really had no clue who I was, let alone who I wanted to become, or what I could or should bring into a marriage. And that made being a couple a bit difficult. During that time, we had some friends, Daniel and Laney Allen, who pastored a tiny little church in Arcadia. It was smaller than our Sunday school class at Lake Avenue, quite a bit smaller. But they offered friendship and support to us when we needed it the most. Eventually, we made the difficult decision to change churches, not because we were dissatisfied with Lake Avenue in any way. We loved it, but mostly because we needed some personal TLC and accountability as we attempted to put our marriage back together. Arcadia Fellowship became a place of healing where we discovered that God was not remote at all, but rather, He offered healing and comfort and personal care, both in and through Himself and the body of Christ. Those were rich days for us, and we established a support network that saw us through the darkest times and continues today. Sadly, while we were becoming more healthy, the church was not. At its inception, Arcadia Fellowship was a church of God. It was very fundamental, which basically means if it's not in the Bible, they don't do it. As in, there were no electric or bass guitars or drum sets or keyboards. So contemporary worship bands were not really a part of their culture. That's how it started. But as more young families moved in and joined the church, shortly before we did, contemporary music sort of sneaked in the back door, and one by one, the contemporary instruments joined them. And it began leaning toward and looking more and more like a vineyard, as Daniel was profoundly influenced by John Wimber. So this tiny congregation was actually two congregations, the younger at heart and the old guard. And the old guard sat firmly planted in the back two rows, with their arms folded, and chiseled frowns gracing their holy countenance. I was once asked recently why I tend to play keyboards with my eyes shut. Well, it all began there. It's because it was really hard to worship when people were scowling at me. So I learned to shut my eyes so that I could worship God and think about Him and not about them. And it kind of stuck. Anyway, there came a time where the back row folks left, and they took their tithes with them. So Arcadia Fellowship merged with Monrovia Vineyard. In that chat, that church was pastored by Steve Summerall, some of you have met him, who was just sticking his toes into spiritual formation in the contemplative stream of spirituality. He was heavily influenced by Dallas Willard, and that turned my spiritual life upside down. You see, since my time at Lake Avenue Congregational Church, I was heavily involved in leadership, in serving, and in community. But I was doing it all because I assumed that's what good little Christians did. I did it all on my own strength, lending my own good ideas and vim and vigor to the cause. I prayed, but my prayers were really mostly a grocery list of things I wanted God to do for me. I worshiped, but honestly, I did it because it made me feel good to do so. Now, while that's not all bad, it's not all good either. And as I listened to Steve's sermons and read books by Dallas Willard, Richard Foster, Ruth Haley Barton, and many others, I noticed something. Their good works came as a result of their relationship with Christ, their interactions with Christ when no one was looking. They were living, as we say, from the inside out, from that place where Christ dwelt richly within them. I didn't do that. The good things I did were my attempt to make myself acceptable to God so that He would have a relationship with me. I was backwards thinking. Well, eventually, Ben and I made our way to Ventura Vineyard. It was an accident, really. We were at Monrovia Vineyard, a stone's throw from the church, and I was leading worship there. Both kids were about to leave the nest, they were going on with their lives, and we spent a lot of time watching television. And one day we looked at each other and we said, we've got to get a life. So Ben learned to sail, and I began doing music gigs for whoever would ask. And one of those gigs was to fill in for the keyboardist, who was not available to do a wedding with the rest of his worship team. That worship team was from the House of Praise in Ventura. Well, they asked me to send them a demo tape, and because I'm a bit of a brat, I refused. So they asked me to come up on a Saturday night to play keyboards and see how it went. They did, I did, and the rest is history. The House of Praise became Ventura Vineyard, and we've now been there for about 21 years. So I'm a Congra Katha Prespa Nazza Gatzio Cadia Vignitarian. 68 years of church in one word. Okay, I've gone to a lot of churches. I don't consider myself an ex-Catholic, an ex-Presbyterian, an ex-Nazarene, or an ex-anything. All of these things have woven irreplaceable threads into the fabric of who I am, and I treasure each and every one of them. So there's my history, in a nutshell, for a bit of a nut that I am. And that leaves us with the question, why do I go to church? Well, I can tell you in six S's. The first is searching. The church was there when I was searching for something to believe in, when I realized there was more out there than just me, and trying to wrap my mind around what that might be. I'm not done searching. God continues to unfold himself and delights me with his never-ending layers. The second S is seeking. The church was there when I first was introduced to the triune God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, when I first began to read the Bible. The church helped me in my seeking to refine my focus, to grapple with what truth is, and to hone in on what I really believe. My seeking also continues to this day and likely always will. Every time I think I'm close to getting a handle on it, I discover a whole new round of what God is. More layers, more layers, more layers. The third S is soaking. The church was there to immerse me in good, solid teaching of how to live life that was congruent with what I believed. And as I continued on the path and my beliefs became more refined and developed, the way became clearer and the disparity between belief and actual life narrowed somewhat. And it continues to do so. The church is a great crucible of what to do and what not to do. In seeing other believers on their journeys, we learn from their success, from their mistakes, and it helps us grow in our own journeys, and our journey helps them. Next, serving. The church gave me opportunity to serve others, to get out of my own self and my own selfishness, and to consider how I might actually walk along beside other people, inside and outside of the church. And I learned and continue to learn as I go along that even as I serve, I learn more about myself and some of my rough edges that need to be refined by the iron sharpening the iron. Next is savoring. The church gives me opportunities to consider and to marinate in new ways of thinking. My relationship with God and my theology now is no relationship to what it was 10, 20, 30 years ago. There are new images of God, new ways of reading and understanding the Bible, new ways of understanding the culture that it was written in, new ways of being that are spurred on by those who think differently than I think. The church presents a challenge to my status quo, and it causes me to grapple with things that I could and would otherwise ignore. Next, sinking deeper. The church offers opportunities to dig deeper into the Word, deeper into my relationship with God, deeper into worship, deeper into what it means to love, what it means to sacrifice oneself, deeper into what it means to lay down my preconceived notions and to listen to other perspectives. The value of slowing down, of pondering, lingering, of silence, and of listening for God's whispers. Each of the six S's is a continual stream in my life. The Benedictine fathers have a saying, always we begin again. And that is the posture that I choose to adopt. I will never know it all. I will never have a handle on it all. I will never have arrived. I am a perpetual student of God and of life, and along with the promised new mercies every morning, there are new revelations and epiphanies each day that I value more than I can ever express. Is the church, our church, any church, perfect? Of course not. And if it was perfect, the moment I walked through its doors, it would cease to be so, because I'm not, and I'd bring my imperfections into it. What the church is a place to do life, a family of quirky, imperfect, fantastic folk who are going through life the best that they can, folks who you would naturally gravitate towards, and those you would not. But each bears the mark of God and is his handiwork. Each is beloved of God, and each has something to sow into your life if you will let them. And the funny thing is, probably the more unlike you they are, the more there is for you to learn from them. So I go to church. Why? To be stretched, to be shaken out of my complacency, to encounter God in worship, in the Word, and in those around me. I can read about God in books, and I do. I can see His handiwork in nature, and I love to. I can encounter Him in prayer and in private worship. But none of these things cause me to consider and reconsider my thoughts and perceptions in the way that being in church with you, all of you, each of you, can do. Because our church isn't a building. It's you. It's me. It's us doing life together in the grace of God. So I do get up early on Sunday mornings. And even though right now I can still do church in bunny slippers sipping tea, I long for the day when we can be together in person, when iron can sharpen iron again, when we dance through life together, when we step on each other's toes, when feelings get hurt and egos get bruised, when faith is shaken and restored, when our conception of God clash and shatter. But when we work through those things together and still love one another, and because of it, we learn how to do life just a little bit better, to love a little bit deeper, and to put up with each other just a little bit more. That, my dear family, is why I go to church.